Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
81 minutes in, and we are montaging away.
Yes, indeed.
Hal, so much to talk about in this minute, so why don't you give us the lowdown?
So much to talk about, and yet no dialogue. But that's part of the essence of a good montage.
For sure.
As we discussed in our last episode. All right. The battle montage surges forward as Captain America catches his vibranium shield midair. A Hydra truck erupts in a fiery blast nearby. Steve and his howling commandos charge through a pine forest, gunfire and explosions ripping through the trees on both sides. Jim Morita, crouched in the shadows, whistles and flashes a signal with his flashlight as a Hydra convoy rumbles past. Dernier darts onto the road, sliding beneath an armored car to attach a time delay bomb to its chassis. He stands, plugging his ears as the car explodes in a ball of flame, then rubs his hands together, grinning at the success. The commandos, watching from the forest, exchange satisfied smiles. In a darkened London theater, Colonel Phillips and Peggy Carter watch a newsreel showcasing the commandos' exploits. On screen, Steve and his team huddle over a map spread on over a Jeep's hood, Steve aligning it with a compass that holds a tiny photo of Peggy inside its case. Phillips glances at Peggy with a sly grin. She stares at the screen, her face carefully neutral, masking her feelings. At another Hydra facility, Bucky Barnes peers through Stark's high-powered rifle sight, scanning the perimeter. He fires, dropping a Hydra guard with a single shot. Steve glances back, saluting Bucky with a nod. In the Strategic Scientific Reserve headquarters, Peggy removes more Hydra flags from the tactical map, each one a victory. Steve, elsewhere, slams his shield into Hydra soldiers, knocking them out cold. In a striking moment, Captain America hurls his shield in slow motion, a fireball blooming behind him. Leaping onto a Hydra tank, Steve smashes the hatch open with a single blow from his shield.
Wow.
A lot going on in this minute of montage.
A lot going on in that minute, including that epic, you know, straight from the comics frame of flinging the shield at the camera. And
yeah.
which remains an integral part of the Marvel the credit fanfare, introduction to the fanfare. Yeah. It's still there.
It's beautiful too. I mean, it's just, you couldn't draw it better. And I get the feeling Joe probably had that he probably had that on his storyboard. I want this and then build everything up around it.
It really is straight out of the comics. There are some scenes in Marvel movies that I just set a shiver down my spine because they were straight out of the comics. And that was one of them, just that little bit. That's Captain America, man.
Yeah. You know, I really want the lunchbox for this scene. everything in here looks like, I am dating myself, but like the Rat Patrol or Garrison's Gorillas or Combat. Yes. These were all the TV shows that I grew up with in the 60s, and they all had scenes like this of some, especially Garrison's Gorillas was always, for some reason, everybody had to have a satchel charge. That's where I learned the phrase satchel charge. You had to have you needed a satchel and you needed full of charges.
And a charge.
Yeah. So go back for the detonators. They'd have the dynamite, but they forget the detonators. And
well, we've kind of lamented that we don't get a lot of Howling Commandos in this movie, but I think this minute is a terrific glimpse at the Howling Commandos. Their camaraderie, the way they work, the way they're a tight team, sort of the humor and lightness they bring to it. I love that shot of Darnier standing in the road, plugging his ears with his hands. as the vehicle blows up.
It's le just boom.
Le boom. Yes, exactly. It's beautiful.
Wow. And, and then this, the business with, Peggy seeing, they just happened to capture a picture of Peggy inside of,
Steve's. I love that so much.
That's so nice. That's Cliff Secord with Jenny.
Kissing his thumb and putting it on the picture. They're both, you could see Cap and the Rocketeer comparing their little snapshots of their girlfriends. You got a girl back home. Her name's Jenny.
And I love Tommy Lee Jones and Haley Atwell sitting in the theater watching the film of Peggy appearing in his compass. Right. Peggy's got this, as you wrote in the description, Jim, and Hal narrated a very neutral expression, but you can, I can see, I can imagine something flickering across her face, something like embarrassment, but also kind of happy, you know, and Tommy Lee Jones, in my mind, casts the perfect smirk. If you wanted to, if you want to picture a smirk in the dictionary, you look at Tommy Lee Jones side-eyeing Peggy Carter at this moment, because you know he's on to her. He's always been on to her, but he's on to her, and he knows she's embarrassed. And then it's watching a newsreel in a theater is a really weird way to get confirmation that the guy you like likes you back.
In front of everybody.
Everybody. You know, in junior high or high school, maybe you'd be passing notes, but no, now we're watching newsreels that the whole world is seeing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's interesting. This is the third time I remember. Well, actually, there's more scenes. Joe posts so many scenes in theaters, and we've seen three different ones in this movie. We've seen at the beginning where, you know, skinny Steve is watching a newsreel only to get beat up later on in the alleyway outside the theater. We also saw during the when he's fighting with Radio City Hitler, we see the senator as, you know, as they're going through this yet another montage where he's going to Buffalo and Philadelphia and all these other things. We see the senator, Senator Brandt, sitting there nodding his head in approval. And it's just interesting that Joe thinks so much about what's it like being out in the audience. What's going on out there. So,
very well used in The Rocketeer with the newsreels about what was going on and.
Burying half of Europe and, you know, discussing all that.
Exactly. And Cliff and Jenny sitting there to watch the latest, tripe from Neville Sinclair.
It does give you a context and a sense of what the world knows about Captain America. Is he he could be a big secret agent that nobody knows about, but he's in the newsreels. He's a hero. And we know that everybody in the world is watching these newsreels of Steve being a hero. So I think it gives you some context of, you know, this isn't James Bond's secret agent that nobody knows publicly. This is a public facing force of the American army.
Yeah, and for the American audience or the world audience, it's a continuity because we saw him when he was movie Steve and he was marching on a treadmill with all those guys with, you know, a bunch of potted palm trees, going over the top. But it was the Hollywood studio. But now this is, for all intents, this is real. He's somewhere in Bavaria attacking Hydra. It's a beautiful way of thinking of the 40s. I mean, it really puts and putting us in the audience gives you the feeling that you're part of this all.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, the one thing that I'm saying this very tongue in cheek because it wouldn't have added anything to the story. It would have been just a big distraction. But you can easily imagine headlines on the newspapers in a couple of days. You know, who is Cap's mystery gal?
Poor Peggy.
Freeze frame of that shot. Does eligible bachelor Cap really have a sweetheart back home?
That's an interesting observation. I like that, Hal.
Yeah, I have to give a behind-the-scenes thing here. When I was writing all these different descriptions, and I was trying to type Howlin' Commandos with L-I-N apostrophe, Microsoft Word would not let me alter it. Even when I went in to try to – it insisted on howling. So if if you're reading any of the summaries on the website, I tried. I really tried to have it.
We know they're howling.
Another howling. So just ignore that G.
And Dum Dum at least did howl once. You know, they're in the truck very early on. We got one good, wahoo out of him for that.
So Hal, you're a Howling Commandos expert on this podcast. I'm wondering what you think of this minute and the depiction of the Commandos. And I feel very positive about it. I don't know how you feel.
Well, I shrug off the mantle of expert, but I did read a lot of them as a kid and I've been going through them again currently. And I was going to say as we speak, but I'm actually paying attention and I'm on the show right now. But relatively speaking in life, and I absolutely love it. I mean, I've really had a fondness for those characters as a kid and it's great to see them coming to life. And it's, you couldn't... They're presented here with respect to the source material, obviously with the major difference being, you know, Nick Fury isn't leading them around. This is Cap leading them, but his support team. To me, everything about it is very faithful without it being a literal interpretation, which would be a bit silly. I mean, it would be a little bit too dimensional. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I love the characters, and I love in the comics that even, you know, back in the very early 60s, you know, less than 20 years after World War II, we had this really interesting and varied group of some different nationalities and different countries, and everybody's sort of working together and everybody's got their talent. But, you know, you still had, you know, you had Rebel, who just, his dialogue bubbles are written in kind of a cringy Southern accent, and all he wants to do is play another game of poker, and Dum Dum, as we've said, you know, wants to complain about his wife and mother-in-law and stuff like that. And it works well in that context, but you'd have to refine that a little bit for this. And so what we do see of them, I think, is great. As you guys have said, I'd love to see Howling Commandos movies. And I know there's some little bits that pop up here and there in Agent Carter and things like that, but
yeah, and that's, of course, after the war, that's the only downside of, you know, right. Okay, they did eventually, you know, I mean, worked it with S.H.I.E.L.D. and stuff. Yeah. One of the things I don't know that well, I mean, I read some Howling Commandos, but I don't really know the background of everybody, and I always get the impression that there might be something of a, well, I grew up with the Dirty Dozen movie, or the Garrison Guerrilla. Garrison Guerrillas was about a group of convicts that were recruited for special yeah. missions because, you know, safe cracker and a guy that's explosives expert and things like that. Were there any ex-cons, or, you know, they were given a reprieve if they joined the Howling Commandos? Was anybody like that? Did they have a criminal background?
Not that I recall or that I have come across, you know, recently reading the first maybe couple dozen issues so far. I haven't come across anything like that. They're generally, you know, they're the guys you can't really control that much. They're maybe not the most disciplined, but yeah. they're known everywhere as, you know, as being the best of the best, although they do have a team of, they've got rivals on both the friendly side and the enemy side. I think Dum Dum, you know, came from a background as a boxer.
Yeah, a strong man,
yeah.
right?
Was a strong man. Yeah, yeah. That circus strong man. You picture him saying bully a lot. And I think, as we have said very early in that, I think the first issue, he was British, and then they just decided he wasn't anymore. And in through the comics, they often describe his hat as a fedora, and that, to me, that's a
no,
derby.
No, that's 100% a derby. Or a bowler, isn't it? More of a
bowler, yeah. Bowler.
Or bowler, yeah.
Yeah. And then, yeah, Dino, Italian guy who paused his successful acting career to go be a commando. But you're talking about Captain America. You know, he's not James Bond. He's a well-known instrument. Certainly in the comics, the commandos, every German, you know, everyone in the Wehrmacht and the SS knows exactly who all of these guys are, you know, and it's like, oh no, it's their Wehrmacht commandos and they're here again. And, you know, it's like, we better run or I'll be a hero because I'm going to be the one who gets them finally. And they're very, very well known.
I have to tell you, my headcanon is that the Howling Commandos know everybody in Hogan's Heroes.
Yes.
Ooh, yes.
Yeah. I can yes. see them actually working yes, together. Or being yes, another
Denier
version.
And LeBeau probably yeah. grew up in the same little French village.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, I mean, it's, you know, Carter probably knew the Dum Dum. And
yeah. it's a neat comparison that hadn't occurred to me, but, you know, Hogan's Heroes came along a few years after Howling Commandos comic books started up. Right. I wonder if the people who made Hogan's Heroes are reading those comic books, because it's the same kind of crew. You got a,
yeah.
well, you know, it's a German and an Englishman and they're all clever and they've got their specialties of, you know, digging tunnels or wiring phones or whatever they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, all of those mid-60s, early-60s, you know, I mean, you think everything from the Great Escape to Stalag 17, all of, you know, they all had that idea that there's a bunch of things going on that they're doing under the nose of the Germans. Yeah. And this, I mean, there's nobody, the Howling Commandos are not behind, well, they are behind the lines, but they're not, you know, infiltrating German society. Although, Hal, have you seen something where they are in, you know, like pretending to be good Germans? And
There's actually a fair amount of that, or at least, you know, and I'm drawing a blank now. Was one of the commandos does speak German, but the rest don't. So if they need to get somewhere and we need to punch out a Nazi soldier and switch clothes, okay, you're the one who's going to do the talking and get us through the next checkpoint and things like that.
Yeah, I don't know if that would work in this movie.
Right. There's a reasonable amount of that. But it's not long term. It's not like I'm going to go undercover and on assignment for months or something. It's like, well, you know,
this mission,
we got to get in there and do this and get back out. And then Brian, you know, you call out everybody, they all have their specialties and they all have their characteristics. And it's always fun because there'll be some good natured ribbing, you know, back at the barracks and things when they're in battle. The only teasing they do with each other, other than Fury calling them yard birds and gold bricks and all these other wonderfully antiquated insults, the only real ribbing is it's basically save some for me. You know, don't go punch out all the Nazis because I want to punch a few too. And so just this scene where, you know, the rest of the guys are kind of cheering on Dernier with his planting the satchel charge under the armored car and stuff. They, you know, they're looking, they're happy. Yep. That's his thing. And he was the wiry little one who could duck under it and do it. And everybody's going to do the thing that they're good at.
So go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, it was like Gimli in the Lord of the Rings saying, no, that one counts as one, it's two. So just fighting with elves.
It occurs to me that this motif of, you know, a bunch of disparate people coming together to work as a team, probably, I wonder if it mirrors the direct experience of all these people who were making movies and comic books in the 50s and 60s, who many of them fought in World War II. When you'd have a guy from the Bronx, you know, next to somebody from California, next to somebody from the South, next to somebody from Montana. And all these guys came from, I say guys because I'm, you know, speaking of male soldiers in combat, came from all over the country. You know, there wasn't mass media like there is today. If you lived in the Bronx, you'd probably never seen somebody from Montana. And they all came together and they're all different people and they're all different, you know, backgrounds. And they made these cohesive units. And I bet you that experience of having that at a smaller scale happened, seeing that firsthand in World War II, probably informed a lot of these kinds of movies and stories that came out in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, I would think it would have had to have. And, you know, certainly in the Howling Commandos books, they're, you know, they're frequently reminding the reader, at least as the issue will kick off, you know, this is this story by ex Sergeant Stan and illustrated by ex Corporal Jack, you know, and lots of little things like that, that they'll put in. And I could mention an earlier episode, they even sort of drew and wrote themselves into a scene. So they, you know, quite rightfully, you know, lean into the fact that they have some experience behind this and they're telling these rollicking, you know, very fun adventure stories, but, it, you know, it has to have been informed by that, and you know, what a shift in culture and perspective that would be for some of these guys.
Yeah, especially Jack Kirby. I've got to say again, when we had way back in the early days of this podcast, we had Mark Evanier on, who worked as an assistant to Jack Kirby. And Jack Kirby, man, he was the real deal. He was just a tough, physically small but pugnacious man who fought terrifically and savagely in World War II. I mean, it was just, Jack Kirby was the real deal. He was a soldier to his boots. There's a great apocryphal story about somebody who, gosh, now I'm trying to remember if you told this story before on this podcast, Hal, but somebody objected to something Jack Kirby had written in one of his books, like the Howling Commandos, about Nazis. And he came to the Marvel offices and banged on the door, and he was going to have a word with Jack Kirby about Nazis. And Jack Kirby was going to go down and just clean this guy's clock until somebody told him, you better go away, because that's Jack Kirby, and you know, he'll take you out. I don't care how big you are. But
oh, that's funny. No, I don't think I'd heard that one before. That's
that's
amazing. But it's nice. It gives you that credibility. I mean, the, you know, the Howling Commandos books are not, you know, they're not high literature by any stretch of the imagination, but they're really enjoyable, and it's fascinating for me now. I mean, especially, you know, learning so much that I've learned on the three of us doing this show and things, to just look back and say, okay, this entertained me as a kid. But now I can look at, so what are the techniques? What are the storytelling tools? What are the, you know, what's the world building? What's the character building? And how is all that working? And the, you know, even the tools were arguably simpler then. And, you know, they were trying to crank these issues out fairly quickly. Like one of the things I'm struck by, for example, is how often we have just maybe a close-up of a couple of faces and the background is just, it's just bright red or bright mm-hmm. yellow. It's just these bold primary colors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you sort of look at that, well, that's, you know, they're standing in front of a tent and there's a tank back there. Why is it just a color? As a kid, I would never have noticed that other than probably some subconscious thing that just says, you know, this is bold and bright and primary colors and it's part of action and interesting things. But now I look at it and think that's a really fascinating choice. And I don't ever ask, why did they do that? I'm asking myself, why does that just work?
Yeah. And when you consider that the whole thing was, you know, at the time it was ephemera, it wasn't considered, you know, this isn't art for the ages. Right. I mean, if you go through old microfilms, or now you can look at digital copies of old comic strips and newspapers from the 30s and 40s and stuff like that. Incredibly, you know, like they have these incredibly complex stories, but the backgrounds didn't really matter that much because the paper had a limited shelf life and was going to go in the trash the next day or line a birdcage. And even, you know, the artists that worked on it were masters of their craft, but they had a timeline, they had a deadline to get stuff out. And you're not going to start drawing trees and rivers and lakes in the background when you've got, you know, here's a 4-panel strip, or in this case, here's a 25-page comic that you've got to knock out every panel and have it ready for the inker by Thursday.
I didn't want to disappoint Hal, but I think a lot of the decisions like that you were talking about came down to got to get it done by Tuesday and how cheaply can we do it?
Yeah.
and Jim, what colors, you know, do we have a lot of?
Yeah.
One of the dirty secrets of comic strips is that most of the big comic strip artists, Milton Caniff and, you know, Roy Crane, all these guys, they had assistants who did the backgrounds for them. The main artist would do the faces and the heads and the bodies, but they had somebody else fill in the backgrounds. There were very few one man bands in the old comic strip days.
Now, Brian, as the only, I believe the only Eisner Award winner that I know, or certainly the only one on this show. So, you know, Will Eisner was somebody that, you know, if you're a comics fan, that's kind of, that he's almost one of those guys you're supposed to sort of start with. He's so foundational.
Yeah.
I didn't really come across his stuff until the mid to late 80s when I started getting like the Frank Miller Batman stuff. And then he would talk about Eisner and that economy of storytelling, and then, you know, bought a bunch of the spirit books and stuff like that. To your knowledge, was he, would he have been in that same category? Would he have been somebody who would have had assistance and things, or, I imagine, yes, for some reason in my head, I'm seeing him as, yeah, I'm just a one man band doing my little thing. But
Eisner is actually known for bringing up some wonderful people. The artist Frank Frazetta was an assistant to Eisner for a while.
Yeah. Wow.
And so scholars today will actually go through and try to figure out which pieces Frank Frazetta drew.
just trying to Will Eisner going, wait, I didn't remember drawing some muscular Amazon woman who's scantily clad in the background. What's that about?
Eisner had a whole studio. Eisner was an artist, but he was also a very shrewd businessman, which was unusual in those days. A lot of writers and artists in those days were just brutally taken advantage of, but Eisner had his own shop and almost made his own little factory. And I don't mean that in any disparaging sense, but he had a team of artists who worked for him. He would train up, and then many of them went on to greatness themselves. But you would farm a job out. You would subcontract a job to the Eisner shop, and Eisner would draw some of that. But sometimes Eisner just gave it a nod and said, yep, that's good enough to have put my name on, and that would go out.
That's really interesting. And I just remember being so struck, I don't know if I can think of a good analog, but it's like sometimes when you consume media from another era, like if you watch a film from the 30s or the 40s or so, you can appreciate it. This is brilliant. This is groundbreaking. But sometimes you have to put yourself in the mindset of, okay, I have to imagine that I'm watching this when it was new instead of now.
Yeah.
And like even some of the best classics, you can look back and say, that's a really nice old movie.
Yeah, for them.
If that makes sense, you know, this is really, really good. And I get why I have affection for it now, but I get why it was huge then. But then something like, and I promise I'm going somewhere. There's something like The Best Years of Our Lives. And, you know, Jimmy and I spent a week talking about that on a show. And that to me is there's nothing dated about it.
Yeah, it's transcendent. It really is.
It's in black and white. And this, I'm not disparaging the great films that do get maybe a bit dated, but that you just watch it and you could put it in theaters today and people would say, where's all the colors? Never mind. This is an amazing story. And so when I was first going to read some Eisner stuff, I was remember thinking that my takeaway was going to be, you know, okay, well, this is going to be good and sort of, and maybe detailed and sort of serious for the golden age, for the 40s, yeah, and for that era. And instead it was just, I was just blown away by the storytelling. Some of those, the spirit stuff in particular could have been, it's a masterclass in economical storytelling.
Yeah, the spirit hit a very high standard and that still endures. And still studied.
I found that with, I had a friend whose older brother collected EC comics from, you know, the Tales to Drive You Mad. And that's where I got introduced to Wally Wood. And I could not, like, when you see a Wally Wood frame, every square millimeter has something going on in it. And from what I understand, he drew all of that. And it was just like, I mean, it was like looking at a 1,000-piece puzzle. And
Funny you mention that. Wally Wood also worked some time as an Eisner assistant.
Oh,
Wally Wood worked in the Eisner studio. Jules Pfeiffer worked in the Eisner studio.
Yep. Oh, wow.
It's quite a list. A guy named Jack Cole, who created Plastic Man and did a lot of great comics in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, 40s, 50s at least, was a ghost on The Spirit. It was just a tremendous talent pool. It was kind of like, you know, the Sid Caesar show in the 50s.
Yeah.
Everybody came out of Mel Brooks and Woody Allen and, you know, it's just this hit list of fantastic writers, filmmakers came out of that show. And the Eisner Studios just created this explosion of talent that informed the rest many decades to come.
Yeah, it was an amazing magnet. I mean, I can strongly recommend if anybody can get their hands on an old issue of, I'm thinking of Super Duper Man, which was one of Wally Wood's satires. The page is so packed. I mean, I'm assuming that he did the art and did all the gags too, but it's so just jam packed with stuff. And I keep wondering, you see this thing, it's like, who influenced them? And you think, wow, probably, you know, maybe amphetamines. I don't know what I don't know where, you know, where it came from, but there's just so much. It was it's intense about, and it was done for a medium that really wasn't considered something that you'd want to keep unless mom was going to find it under your mattress. But it was stunning. Well, I think we talked something about the movie. I don't remember, but I think we chatted a little bit about this.
Before we get away from the movie, we've already talked about the wonderful image of Captain America throwing the shield with fireball behind him.
Right.
This minute, in this very minute, is responsible for another one of my favorite images from all of Marvel, all of the film. It's that GIF, however you want to pronounce it, of Captain America saluting Bucky.
Yeah.
I've used that a million times in emails. I send that to my daughters 1,000 times. It works in every situation. Just that salute, like, thanks for having my back, pal. It works every time. If you get on your iPhone and you call up, search for Captain America, that's going to be the first one that comes up, and you send it to somebody. It'll work.
That's just perfect.
Wow. Well, I think we finally made it through the montage portion of the show, and then we're gonna have to go back to a straight old exposition. Well, actually, we're gonna get into complication and resolution coming up very shortly. So we're in the final, I would say, the final third of the movie. This is probably where things are gonna start sewing things up. Don't leave us, because we'd like to hear from you. If you would like to continue this conversation that we're having, we're always available over at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. And if you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.